Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Popped my head like that.
Oh, but yeah. You said it with a little sass.
I was feeling sassy.
Yeah.
I am feeling sassy. Still.
I like it. You look vibrant. You look ready to go.
I'm ready to go. You know when you've been sick, because I've been sick.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, this is now an ailments podcast, everyone. This is now a
we talk about it every
life
time.
Before death.
Get used
true crime
to it.
Podcast.
Oh.
I've been sick, and so what happens to me after I've been sick is like the day I feel better, I go into this like hypomanic.
What can I do?
Flying around the house.
Let's go.
Cleaning. Like, you should have seen me yesterday. I was washing the bathroom rugs. I was doing loads of laundry. I was cleaning the whole house. I mean, it was amazing.
Maybe I should get sick like that so I have a burst of energy.
But I'm just like, oh, I could do anything right now.
Ah, nice.
So I'm still kind of feeling energetic. TBH.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I like that.
How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah. I would like to go to sleep, but I'm excited to sit here and talk to you.
And so when I text you and I was like, when are we recording? And you're like,
I'm coming over right now. I'm like,
she ate dog food as a she was like, I'll eat a snack before you come, and I get here and there's a big bag of dog food over here. And I was like, Lena, you didn't have to eat dog food.
Yeah,
she doesn't eat dog food. She just, it was a joke.
Yeah,
as my 4-year-old says, it was just a joke.
Yeah. I did. When I was a teenager, I knew some guys that ate wet dog food.
Ew.
Just as a dare. Like, let's just, they even put it in a bowl with the spoon. I was like, yeah, I want to throw up just thinking about it.
I don't even know what to say. I mean, I probably know the guys you're talking about. Oh, man. Oh, man. Hey, this might not pique your interest as much as it piques mine.
Ooh, I'm intrigued.
But guess who's touring? I just learned a few days ago that Incubus is touring. They're not just touring. They're touring their Morning View album.
Okay.
So that album is...
Are they coming around this area?
They will be here in September.
Oh, so you're going to be getting tickets.
I would love to go. I got to find someone to go with me. I know Incubus isn't really your thing.
Yeah. I mean, it was back in the day.
Yeah. Well, I am so excited. So.
Okay.
Maybe it's in my future.
Grayson was just telling me the other day that he wants to go to a Coldplay concert with you.
I will absolutely go to a Coldplay concert with
him. I told
him
that. He's like, Candace likes Coldplay, right?
Like them. They're my favorite of all time.
Yeah, just ask her. She'll go with you.
When are they coming here?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't even know if there's
never
a chance.
See, when we lived in Charleston, nobody came to Charleston.
Oh.
I mean, nobody. Nobody that I loved. You would have to drive to Charlotte to see someone like Coldplay or Taylor Swift or whoever.
Mm.
And now that I'm in Dallas, I can see anyone.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm really excited.
We've got lots going on here.
So much to do. So much to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let's just get into it. The story I have for you today is a mysterious death case.
Mysterious.
Although you may be able to make your mind up rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I was. I say mysterious death because we can't truly say what happened to her, because none of us were there.
Okay.
And her family very much feels like justice was not served in this case. There was a really good episode of Crime Scene Confidential with Alina?
Why did I say Which it like is that? It?
Alina Burrows. She's a crime scene investigator and she has her own show now. So I used that episode to like bolster my initial research.
Oh, okay.
I really like her a lot. She's got pink hair, a nose ring, tattoos, but she's so professional. Like she just comes off really, she's very serious. She's very smart. And anyway, so I really like that episode. You can go check it out. Trigger warning now. There will be talk about domestic violence and suicide.
Oh, no.
So just hold on to your butts for that. Okay, December 19th, 1992, a frantic phone call came into 911. A husband was screaming that his wife, 24-year-old Michelle Witherell, had jumped from their third floor balcony.
Oh.
Yeah, the caller, Jeremy Witherell, told dispatch that his wife was badly injured, but she was still clinging to life, and he begged them to hurry. Please hurry to the LaVale Apartments.
Okay.
Okay. Now, Michelle Dawn Melema, that's her maiden name, was born December 23rd, 1967, in Parker, Colorado, to parents Everett and Kathy Melema. For her whole life, she was really involved in 4-H.
Oh, she's a country girl.
She is a country girl. She started at the age of 9. She raised sheep and showed Arabian horses.
Cool.
She was really good at it. She grew up in Parker, and after graduating high school, she went into the family business and became a licensed real estate agent and worked with her parents. Now, her family described her as being funny and kind, having a really strong faith in God, and they felt like her attitude about life was just like set her up for a really good future. You know, when you have a positive perspective and
yeah,
like, good things, you just attract good things, good people. That's the idea anyway.
Okay.
there isn't much in the way of how Michelle met Jeremy Witherell, but that's probably because it was far from a storybook romance. Mm. But they loved each other at one point, I guess, enough to marry in September of 1992, just months before this happened. Jeremy had a job opportunity with his brother in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. So they relocated there to start their new lives.
Hmm.
That's where they got their a little apartment and, you know, everything. So let's go back to the night Michelle died. I want to talk more about the scene as it was. When police arrived after that 911 call, Jeremy said he had attempted life-saving measures, so CPR, and he turned her on her side to, you know, clear her airway, things of that nature, because he relayed on the phone to 911 that she was still breathing.
Okay.
So Monroeville police were the first to arrive on the scene, and they witnessed Michelle laying on the ground out front of the apartment building, and her husband, Jeremy, was like cradling her, hysterical. The police department didn't have a whole lot of experience with homicide cases, which they felt like this might be. They just, when they got there, they just, you know, they just know.
Right.
That things don't add up.
Okay.
Okay. He said she jumped. She's laying like this. There's blood here, you know.
And he says he touched her, moved
her. Yeah. So there's all these little aspects and they're like, we need to call in somebody else. So they called in the county police to assist them. We know that law enforcement should treat every crime scene like a homicide until it's determined to be otherwise, right?
That would be smart.
Yeah. Even if you rolled up and someone was hanging from a belt,
okay,
from a ceiling fan, you make sure you dot your I's, cross your T's, get all the evidence, you know, treat it like a homicide until you're like, okay, they definitely did this. You know, this is a suicide. So even when Jeremy told them that she jumped from the balcony, making it seem like she was taking her own life, they still had to secure the scene, preserve the evidence available to them at the time. And then after a thorough investigation has been done, you can say, okay, this was a suicide or this was an accident.
Okay.
These police officers sort of did that in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was a large pool of blood on the concrete next to her. Mm. So imagine, say you're standing in the parking lot and you're looking up at the balcony she fell from. Just below the balcony is like a patch of grass mm-hmm. and a curb. A concrete curb.
Okay.
And then concrete extending out, which you are standing on looking at the balcony from.
Okay.
Okay. So Jeremy was covered in her blood from cradling her and trying to save her life. We talk about this often in cases where the crime scene is rarely ever pristine. And in this case, Michelle was still alive. So the priority for the first responders here was to save her life. They're not worried about disturbing the crime scene, you know, smearing blood or, you know, they're trying to save her and that's their top priority. But here's what we do know about the scene when Michelle was removed and taken to the hospital. So when county officers arrived, Michelle had already been taken away. So they didn't have the luxury of seeing her where she was laying, whatever. Okay. They just kind of heard from the first responding officers how she was found.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they measured the balcony from the balcony to the ground, et cetera, and they found an 8-inch circular indentation about 2 to 3 inches deep in the wet grass.
Oh.
The grass was damp, I guess from rain or from snow, just below their balcony. Now, I just told you there was blood from her head wound on the pavement.
Right.
Okay. Adjacent to the grassy area. So did he move her so that the blood kind of ran down that curb and onto the pavement? We don't know.
Okay.
So because Alina said that, Alina, the crime scene investigator, she said that blood would have poured from the head wound rather quickly.
Okay.
So the minute the impact took place, she would have started bleeding immediately.
Right. Okay.
So in your mind, you're kind of now thinking like where she was injured.
Mm-hmm.
And this will all make sense while I'm kind of talking about this. It is reported that Michelle was found between 3 to 9 feet from the building. I know that's a huge discrepancy. However, I just explained that he likely moved her before first responders arrived. So where that impression was not where she was found when the first responders got there.
Okay.
So he likely moved her. And then she may have been moved again by the paramedics.
Okay.
Right? I know it's confusing, but this is a mysterious death and I want to explain everything.
Yes, please do.
So this debate is less important to me than her injuries, like where she was found, and you'll see why. One of Michelle's shoes was found near her body, but the other shoe was missing.
Okay.
Police looked around for it. They expanded their search further around the apartment complex because Alina said on Crime Scene Confidential that wherever that second shoe is would indicate a second crime scene.
Oh. I mean, or in my mind, she was putting on her shoes thinking, I just need to get out of here. And then she's like, no, just I'm going to jump. And she had one shoe on. Was the other shoe in the apartment?
No.
Wasn't in the apartment. Okay.
It wasn't found.
Anywhere.
Anywhere.
In or around. Okay.
Isn't that weird?
That is very strange.
Yeah, it's weird. So naturally, police wanted to go check the Witherell's apartment. So they hiked up the stairs with Jeremy. And when they got there, Jeremy unlocked the door.
Okay.
He unlocked the bottom lock and he unlocked the deadbolt.
Okay.
On the door.
Interesting find.
Yeah. Police immediately think if he just saw his wife fall or jump from the balcony, why did he feel the need to lock up the apartment, both locks?
Before going to try to save.
Before running to her aid.
Interesting.
Not one lock, but two. That's okay. Now, the apartment itself was untidy, but not like an all-out brawl took place there. I said brawl. Not brawl.
Brawl.
It was just before Christmas, so there was like wrapping paper rolls set out. There was presents already wrapped. Their bedroom kind of looked like mine, you know, a pile of clean laundry that you hadn't put away. You know, there was stuff hanging out of drawers, but it just looked like
lived in.
Oh, exactly. Okay. Now, Jeremy's attorney would later point out this fact and say, well, if there was this huge fight in the apartment, there would be things overturned, broken items. There was no blood in the apartment or signs of anything that she was killed there. And thrown over the balcony. So once inside, Jeremy was allowed to change his shirt.
Oh, no.
Why? Why'd they let him do that?
But, I mean, could they at least say, okay, hand over your shirt? Like,
there was nothing in any of the reports that he handed over his shirt.
Dude.
They didn't collect that evidence, I don't believe. Sounds like they just kind of looked around and didn't see anything weird, and they left.
Okay.
So to say that they didn't find any blood in the apartment, or they didn't find her shoe there, or this, that, and the other, did they really do a thorough search? Mm-hmm. I mean, there were pictures taken of the inside of the apartment.
Okay.
But did they look under the bed? Did they, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Did they move the sheets? Did they, I don't know. So police spoke with Jeremy, who did a voluntary statement at that time, to learn what in the world happened. Like, how'd that happen? How'd she fall off or jump off or whatever? So he explained that he and his wife went out to dinner at the Parkway Tavern in Monroeville. They had a couple of pitchers of beer, and then they got into an argument, which cut the night short. He made a comment about a lady who was walking by in a Hooters shirt.
Oh, geez.
I don't know what he said. He told the police he didn't remember what he said. But Michelle did not take too kindly to him
gawking,
making some, immature remarks. So she got up and walked out. So they got the bill, headed home in silence, and they were at odds when they got back to the apartment. Now, instead of saying to her, Michelle, I was a huge douchebag back there.
Mm-hmm.
Please forgive me.
Yeah.
He told police that he ignored her and played solitary in the living room.
Okay. That's a great idea.
What a guy.
Yeah.
You know, giving her space, I guess. He went on to tell investigators that they were newlyweds, but they did have some domestic situations. He didn't elaborate.
Of course he wouldn't want to.
Yeah. Domestic situations, I don't think that's normal for newlyweds. It's more like honeymoon phase.
Right.
But we'll get into that. So while he's playing cards in the living room by himself, mm-hmm. he says Michelle was standing out on the balcony. Imagine, if you will, he's seated on the couch. If he extends his right arm out, he could touch the patio glass of the balcony.
Okay.
There were no curtains there, so he could very well see her if this is happening the way he says. So the couch is right next to the sliding glass door that leads to the balcony, so he has this clear view of her standing there. He didn't say what she was doing out there. It's presumed that she was having a beer because there was an opened can of beer on the patio. Remember, he was ignoring her, so says he wasn't paying attention to her.
Did they test the DNA on this beer can?
I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I don't know about this case, which is why it's mysterious.
Okay.
He just knows that he hadn't heard from her for a while, and then he thinks he heard like a thud, which prompted him to go out onto the balcony, and then he looked down and saw her on the ground.
Okay.
That's story number one.
Oh, okay.
The balcony itself was a solid half wall. So there wasn't railing. It was like a solid wall, half wall, standing about 3 feet, 4 inches high, according to the crime scene photos. And the top ledge and the outside of the wall, so like the outer portion, was made of like a stucco rock material.
Oh,
so there was like, you know,
rigid
90s chic.
If
you can imagine. But it was in terrible condition.
Mm.
It was like peeling off, and I'll post some photos on our Instagram so you can see it. Now, the photos from the night Michelle died showed damage on the top of the ledge, like a patch of damage on the top of the ledge where it had, the stucco had been ripped away from the wall.
Wow. Okay.
Definitely looks like she went over.
Okay.
There was some talk in the Crime Scene Confidential episode about her have been hit in the head and then been placed on the ground. Like maybe she was hit. He followed her downstairs or something, hit her, and then placed her on the ground. But it definitely looks like she fell from the balcony.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm just kind of mentioning these things as we go along.
Yeah.
Now, Michelle was fighting for her life at Mercy Hospital. On top of all of her injuries, toxicology showed a blood alcohol level of 0.195, which is almost twice the legal limit, driving limit, according to Pennsylvania. Now, not that she was driving, but just for reference. That wasn't really a revelation because there was a beer can on the balcony. Jeremy said they were drinking at the restaurant that they ate at beforehand, so it wasn't too far-fetched. But I mentioned the intoxication because later at trial, they alleged that Michelle was just so drunk, she sat up on the edge and fell over. Michelle's parents flew from Pennsylvania to Colorado on the first plane they could.
Well, yeah.
As soon as they could, and buy a ticket and get to the airport.
Oh, I couldn't even imagine.
I know. So they ended up making it to the hospital while she was still alive. She was unresponsive, but she did squeeze her dad's hand.
Oh.
Yeah. But sadly, that head injury eventually claimed her life.
How do you survive that?
Just was no coming back from that. And I'll get into her injury specifically, but she died hours later, hours after she got to the hospital. Michelle's death was classified as undetermined because there wasn't really enough to say one way or the other, and the findings only led to further questions. Now, we'll get into her injuries in a second when we get to the trial. I want to go through the expert testimony like the jury kind of had to hear it.
Okay.
After her autopsy, the investigation was closed, and it stayed closed for years. But her family was not okay with that. They're like, no, this is not right. You can't just say, well, we don't know, and then close the case.
No, ma'am.
Now, Michelle's family knew things weren't picture perfect in Jeremy and Michelle's marriage.
Ah.
Her mother said that Michelle cried on her wedding day.
No.
But they weren't tears of joy. They were tears of regret.
Oh, no.
Like she was about to make the biggest mistake of her life.
Girl.
And a friend later told the deputy district attorney that she also saw Michelle crying at the reception. And when she asked, are you okay? Michelle said, I think I just made a huge mistake.
Oh, my gosh. My heart.
Can you imagine? Like everybody's, you know, drinking and eating and dancing and it's a celebration. And you're just like, well, crap.
I mean, oh, man.
Yeah. Even though they'd only been married a few months, things were very tumultuous in the relationship. There was emotional and physical abuse. Shortly after they were married on Thanksgiving Day, her sister saw a bruise on her leg and was like, what happened there? And Michelle looked over at Jeremy and kind of said, I'll tell you later. And then later, she was asked about it again. And Michelle said to her sister, oh, Jeremy just pushed me over and I bumped my leg on the table. And she just tried to minimize the incident. Now, police even got the vibe that the marriage wasn't in the honeymoon phase, like I said it should be.
Right.
Because in the apartment, they saw some notes on the refrigerator that raised alarm bells.
Oh, my goodness.
There was a little notepad, almost like a stationery, like it was pre-printed like a honeydew list almost, or a shopping checklist or something like that. And it had little blanks next to each line of whichever thing that applied that day. Okay. So it said, the first line said, we're out of blank. And the second line said, I miss you. The third line said, you did a good job on blank.
Oh.
And then the fourth line was, we need to talk about blank. The last line was, I love you. So you could check off which thing you wanted to draw attention to and then write.
Okay.
See what I'm saying?
Right.
So it seemed like the type of notepad someone would have given them at their wedding or, as a joke or something like that. Mm-hmm. So this particular one on the top of the stack said, it was dated 12/19/92. So that day. Top line said, "We're out of love again."
Oh, no.
The second line was checked off. "I miss you." The third line was checked and said, "You did a good job on the house." So maybe
cleaning
or whatever. Fourth line said, "We need to talk about us again."
Oh, man.
The last line was checked and said, "I love you." And then down below, it was blank. Like it just had a
note section.
Yeah, a note section almost. And it said, "You're being mean again. Be nicer."
Oh.
With lots of exclamations. Yeah. So it just seemed like, you know,
I mean,
they were always kind of fighting.
Yeah.
Is what it seemed like. Maybe that could have been written off as them having a little spat or disagreement or maybe even a joke. But then there was another piece of paper next to it hanging up on the fridge that said Michelle's list.
Oh, gosh.
And it was a list of things she felt like was wrong in their marriage. And it said things like, "Not acting as interested in me or us as you need to."
Okay.
Or as you used to. It said, "Don't seem committed." "Mean mouth." "Acting like I'm a nuisance or pain in the ass."
Oh.
So these are things that she felt needed to be written down.
Yeah.
And put on the fridge so that he would remember how she feels on a daily basis.
Goodness.
And she was basically thinking, this is me being a bitch because I have to tell you what I need.
Yeah. I mean, kind of like a passive aggressive.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. And further witness statements from friends and family told the story of a controlling husband
mm-hmm.
who isolated her from family, only letting her work out at the apartment.
Ew.
Like running up and down the stairs.
Wow.
At the apartment. Or like on the immediate grounds of the apartment.
Oh,
things
gosh.
Like that.
Oh, my goodness.
No family wants to understand that their child is in this situation.
Yeah.
And when she died, no family wants to think of their loved one taking their own life.
True.
But there were still a lot of questions about how she died. So Michelle's family has to say, well, maybe she did jump. You have to think of everything.
True.
The more they thought about it, they just couldn't get there. Knowing who she was, knowing her marital situation at the time, and knowing what she said right before her death.
Hmm.
Michelle spoke to her mother the day she died and said she didn't feel like it was God's will to stay in an abusive marriage.
No.
She said that she was going to be returning back to Pennsylvania. And that she'd fill them in on everything that's been happening when she saw them.
Okay.
So she was ready to go.
Yeah.
One thing to understand about her faith is that the Bible taught her to cling to your husband, honor him, and that divorce is not the way to go. But there comes a point where she said, a loving God would not want me to stay in a marriage that I'm being mistreated.
No. I mean, there's a point of, I mean, sticking around and trying and doing what you can, following, you know, God's will for your life. But there's a point, like you're saying, there is a point where you've got to guard your heart. And
well, and if it takes two people. You
absolutely.
Can't just be the only one trying.
Absolutely.
If you're married to a person who's the way they are and they're not interested in treating you better. So, you know, she really did give it a shot. I mean,
yeah.
She stuck it out for a few months. She wrote that list down saying, you need to be nicer. You don't value me like you used to. You know, this, that, and the other. And he didn't care. So, she said it just got too bad.
Mm-hmm.
She was ready to go. Now, Michelle's family was highly suspicious of Jeremy,
mm-hmm.
as you would be, not just because of the history of abuse. I mean, that is a huge factor. But his statements about the night Michelle died kept changing. And they're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What? So he first told police that he didn't even notice Michelle was gone until he heard that thud, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, after Michelle's funeral, Michelle's family, immediate friends and everything, they all went out to dinner. And in her grief, Michelle's sister asked Jeremy, "What happened? I don't get this. Like, what happened?" And he said, "I was playing cards in the living room and I looked over and I saw her hanging from the balcony and I rushed over, but I couldn't make it in time and she just fell."
Mm.
That is a far cry
from just hearing a thud.
For sure. That is entirely a different story. That's story number two.
Did her sister already know the first story that he gave?
No.
Okay.
No, because he had given his statement to police.
Okay.
Now he's telling them this. And so later on, they're like, wait a minute, he told me something different, right? You know? So later he told her parents on a separate occasion that she was hanging lights.
Oh, geez.
Christmas lights off the balcony and she fell. That is so different from story number one and story number two.
Okay, but were there lights on the patio?
No.
On the... What?
I know. No. At least throw some over, throw them out there.
Yeah.
That's your story. That would have been much more believable than all this
hullabaloo.
Now, the family hired a private investigator and experts like Dr. Cyril Wecht to look into Michelle's death. And they all encouraged the family to keep going in their quest for answers. They're like, something's not right here. And that's exactly what they did. They used their life savings, to work with attorneys, forensic pathologists, and this private investigator that they hired. The review of the autopsy piqued their interest because that blunt force trauma to the head.
Right.
Just on the left side. Seems like she was struck in the head with an object instead of impact from the ground. Because remember, where she supposedly landed was soft, wet grass.
Okay.
Now, Dr. John Hiserot, who performed Michelle's autopsy and concluded her death was undetermined, now re-examined the autopsy at the request of the family. And he said, you know, what the evidence actually indicates is a blow to the head.
Mm.
So this is actually a homicide. And he ended up changing.
Okay.
The conclusion.
So we've got someone who's... like,
yeah, he did the initial autopsy.
Yeah.
So he knew his notes. He remembered doing the autopsy. And four separate forensic pathologists also told the family they didn't believe her injuries were from a fall. Now, this led to a coroner's inquest in the summer of 1989, which is not very common, though they do happen when needed. And this was one such occasion that they said, we need to have a meeting of the minds and make a final decision here.
Right.
In a legal capacity.
True.
So they felt they had enough to say that this was a homicide, that Jeremy Witherell was indeed responsible for her death. So they have this coroner inquest as kind of like it's not like a trial, but it's like a hearing, and they do present evidence the same way they would at a trial. So Jeremy was arrested in December of 1999, years and years later,
yeah,
on charges of third-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. By now, he was remarried with an infant.
Oh, no.
Jim Newman vibes?
Living his life.
So the murder trial, let's get to that. The major hurdle the state had to overcome here was that there was no smoking gun, no direct physical evidence that could be presented to support this murder theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they had a buku of circumstantial evidence, starting with the deteriorating and volatile marriage. And the prosecution alleged that Jeremy either overheard her conversation with her mother about wanting to get out of the marriage and move back to Pennsylvania, or that Michelle herself told him,
right,
that it was over. And that was the catalyst for the whole
blow-up. Yeah, if I can't have you, nobody can. Mm-hmm. You're not leaving me.
A nurse and neighbor of the Witherells, Colleen Dunwoody, testified that she heard arguing so loud that it woke her up twice that night.
Well, I'm glad you're mentioning that because I'm sitting here thinking, what did neighbors
exactly
see?
What
see,
did I neighbors wanted to hear? Save the meat.
Okay, meat and potatoes.
The meat and potatoes for the trial bit because this is how the jury had to make their decision.
Okay.
Okay. And the neighbor right below Michelle and Jeremy said that she heard them yelling and screaming at each other 3 to 4 nights a week.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Alina from Crime Scene Confidential visited the Witherells' apartment, the actual apartment, and she said the first thing she heard when she walked in was a baby crying in the adjacent apartment. She could attest to the thin walls right away.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that the neighbors heard them arguing seemed very legit. And I've lived in apartments. You've lived in apartments. Yeah. So you hear sure. you hear stuff.
Yeah.
And multiple neighbors said they heard that patio door slamming multiple times that night. Mm-hmm. Police even found damage to it.
Oh.
Now, all this ear witness testimony casts suspicion on Jeremy's initial story about him just ignoring her the whole time. He's just playing cards. And she just fell or jumped off the balcony. He doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this same witness continued, the Dunwoody lady, the nurse. She said that she heard a woman shouting, no, no, followed by a male voice saying, call 911. She's on the roof.
On the roof.
And this happened minutes before he placed his 911 call.
Okay.
However, as soon as she heard this screaming, she ran down. And kind of looked down because there were garages below. And she's like, on the roof? Like, I don't understand.
Okay.
Like, the roof of what?
Mm-hmm.
So she looks down and there was nothing. And then she saw Michelle.
Oh, okay.
She saw Michelle laying on the ground. But there is no roof. I mean, there's like an awning in the front of the apartment building. And then there's the garages
okay.
that have a roof. But she was like, I don't understand. So let's talk about Michelle's injuries finally. Michelle's autopsy listed blunt force trauma to the head on the left side and blunt force trauma to her extremities. In particular, both of her wrists were fractured and her femur was fractured.
Mm.
Just one. She didn't have any pelvic fracture or internal organ damage, which Alina from Crime Scene Confidential says is typical from a fall from a great height. That's why they were kind of talking about maybe she was placed there.
Okay.
Something else that was absent was injuries to Jeremy. Jeremy's defense attorney argues that if there was this all-out fight, all these witnesses are claiming, Michelle would have fought back and caused at least bruising or scratching or abrasions to Jeremy. To which I say, sir, you must not know much about a battered woman.
Right.
I don't think Michelle fought back anytime during her husband's raising of the hands to her, you know, which is not to say that she didn't have any self-respect. It's just to say that when your partner hits you all the time, you probably turn your head
so you tend to minimize
the damage. You're probably more worried about the bruise that he's going to leave on your face that you're going to have to explain away than fighting back.
Right. Protecting yourself.
She likely didn't fight back. Because this was a pattern.
Yeah.
The major hitch in the case, though, was the conflicting expert opinions.
Ugh.
You had all these reputable, well-respected, educated forensic experts weighing in on the same situation mm-hmm. with very different opinions.
Ah, geez.
So Dr. Cyril Wecht, he's a nationally renowned forensic pathologist. You probably recognize his name. He testified for the state with regard to Michelle's injuries. If you recognize his name, you might remember him from cases like JFK's assassination, Sharon Tate, JonBenet Ramsey, which happened many years after Michelle's death. So he showed the court x-rays of Michelle's head and pointed out the fracture on the left side of her head. He didn't believe this injury could be caused by a fall, but rather blunt force trauma.
Okay.
And he put her body closer to the 9 feet mark away from the building, thus casting doubt on the trajectory of a person having fallen from 33 feet above.
Yeah.
Which was kind of where that indentation was further from the building.
Okay. From where the blood was running down. Okay.
So He's saying she didn't jump or fall off the balcony, and then the wind blew her out further. And okay. then she, you know what I mean? Like, she fell further from the building.
It's science.
They surmise that it is just possible that she was injured elsewhere and placed down below.
Right.
Dr. Werner Spitz, who's also renowned, and you might also recognize his name. He also worked on the JFK, JonBenet Ramsey, as well as Michelle Brown and Dr. Martin Luther King cases.
Goodness.
He said, I believe, in consideration of everything that I know on this case, this was an accidental fall.
Okay.
So here you have two very respectable, intelligent forensic pathologists with very different opinions. Mm. It's a fall. It's not a fall.
Yeah.
So Dr. Wecht says blow to the head. Dr. Spitz says fall.
Okay.
As scientists, we try understanding these questions with data through experiments, right? Now, I'm going to get a little nerdy. Okay. I'm sorry.
Come on with it.
Let me use my science degree for once.
Okay.
Okay. If we don't do the experiments ourselves, we rely on data that's published in papers from respectable scientists who have done their tests and have data to report. They report their method, their sample size, how they conducted their experiment, their compounding factors, anything that's outside that could influence
okay.
the experiment. And then these proposed papers go through a rigorous review before they're actually published.
Right.
Okay? Okay. So you have to think that the data that we gather, the things that we know about science, they're pretty respected, you know? And the other thing is that that data has to be applicable to the general population as a whole.
Oh, okay.
So you have to say, this is true of most people, or this is true of most
situations.
Okay. But if you roll a ball down a hill from the same spot, you will never roll it down the hill the same way every time. Mm-hmm. You could do it 100 times. I've mentioned this before on this podcast. Yeah. I know I have. You've got wind. You've got grass. You've got rocks.
Bumps.
Deficiencies in the landscape. Thank you, Lena. This is why I keep you around. Mm-hmm. All of that to contend with. See, those are the compounding factors, right?
Okay.
And you might be the same person, but you're never going to do it the same way every time, right?
Right. Are you holding it the same way? Are you?
Yeah. Like, you ever watch Plinko on?
Oh, yeah.
So you see someone drop the puck from the same place every time. It's never going to get the $1,000. You know what I mean? But we can use probabilities in science. So we can say that even though it won't happen the exact same way every single time, we can make probabilities of an outcome, right? Okay. I told you I was going to get nerdy. Mm-hmm. Just hang in there with me. I've got a point. All that said, as scientists, they could both be considered to be right. That's the thing. They're talking about prior knowledge and applying it to the situation where they were not present. They're only going off scientific data.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I found nothing of either of them replicating an experiment, like throwing over a dummy. You know, sometimes we see this in cases where they'll throw over a dummy and say she didn't fall or she couldn't have fallen. She was pushed, right. You know, things like that.
Or maybe even she jumped, she lunged.
Exactly. Yeah. So to our knowledge, no one actually saw her land. So no one can attest to what part of her body hit the grass or concrete.
Okay.
We don't know. Allow me for a moment to go further with my nerdiness, just if you will. One of the main points of the differing opinions was the lack of evidence of contra-coup injury. Imagine someone's in a car accident and they hit their head on a steering wheel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Really hard. Well, we would obviously see a coup injury.
Okay.
At the point of impact. That's the coup. But we should see a contra-coup injury from where the brain has bounced back
okay.
and hit the back of the skull. So the opposite coup, contra coup. So like where the brain has bounced back. So take my example of the car accident and the head hitting the steering wheel. Let's say the forehead impacts the steering wheel, we should see injury to the occipital lobe in the back, right, where the brain bounced in the back. However, I'm wondering, if you hit your head on a steering wheel, you're sitting upright, right? If you fall from the third floor, it might not show signs of contra coup injury because now we're contending with gravity.
Okay, right.
So that's a compounding factor, right?
Mm.
So perhaps the brain doesn't have the same opportunity to bounce in a fall as it would if you were sitting upright.
Oh.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Okay. That's why science is so intricate. I know, there's so much to it.
I'm not an expert. I'm just trying to figure out what the jury might have been thinking and had to talk about in their deliberations. Now, Dr. Mary Case actually testified for the defense. She said that we would see coup contra coup injuries from a fall from a great height, but not from 33 feet, which is how far she would have fallen from the balcony. I guess that's not high enough to create that kind of a injury.
Force or...
Exactly. Exactly. I'm not a physicist, but the higher you fall, the more impact.
Yeah.
I'm not saying 33 feet is nothing, but I've seen, you know, reels on Instagram where people are doing parkour or whatever this stupid, and they jump off of like a three-story building onto a pile of dirt and they walk away.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Maybe they break a bone or five, but it's not like they die.
Yeah.
It's not like a high rise or a parking garage.
Hmm.
It's high, but you look down and you say, that's not going to kill me.
But she was really drunk. Her depth perception was off.
True.
Not saying that she did jump,
but
I mean, that has a factor into it too. Like it looks a lot further than it really is.
True. Yeah. It may have looked a lot further. Now, the entire trial lasted just a month and the jury deliberated for only 2 hours. They found Jeremy Witherell not guilty of Michelle's murder.
Knew you were going to say that.
The circumstantial evidence didn't bring it home for them. And the thing is, you ask 12 average Joes to make sense of different expert opinions.
I know.
Doubt it.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed they didn't declare a mistrial and say,
let's try again.
We can't get there. Like, some of us can get there. We can't. But they all agreed they could not get there. Later, some of the jurors said that they felt there was something there, but that the state didn't totally
deliver.
Yeah. They didn't totally, you know, package it all up and convince them without a shadow of a doubt. Didn't this happen in the Casey Anthony case?
Yeah.
Where it was too scientific for those 12 country bumpkins. I'm not sorry. That was back when they showed the jury on TV. So this is why it is considered a suspicious death or a mysterious death, because there are just so many unanswered questions, and each question you think of five more.
Right.
We don't have a conviction here to hang our hats on, so we're left wondering.
Yeah. And it's like Jeremy's the one with the answers here, like the truth.
Yeah. And when he was acquitted, the case was closed. It was officially
they
closed.
They washed their hands.
They said, he's acquitted and case closed.
Wow. I mean, I can respect that these people on the jury, you know, we hear of wrongful convictions and all this and people going to jail that or prison that should not have gone. And so we've got this jury that they weren't sure, and they didn't want to send this man to prison if he really didn't do it. But
yeah,
that is a tough one. Like, see, just like I said a minute ago, in my mind, she was very drunk. I mean, the toxicology report showed that. You can act and think a certain way during that intoxication, and just like...
But was she very drunk? She was drunk by driving standards. But is that so drunk? I mean,
Well, I mean, how big was she? Like,
she wasn't
she
big.
She was petite.
Yeah.
It may not have took a lot for her.
It may have been a very
How much
subjective.
Did she drink? How?
Yeah. And it's hard to say how alcohol affected her, to your point.
Yeah.
Because it's like some people can drink 10 beers and then drive themselves home. No problem. I'm not saying they should. I'm just saying it doesn't affect them like it would someone else.
Yeah.
I had about probably 25 solid questions.
Yeah.
Left unanswered.
Oh, man.
Here. But where is her shoe? Where is her shoe?
Question number one. Where is it?
Where is it? I'm putting that on the list of questions to ask God when I get to heaven. Where is her shoe? He'll know what I'm talking about. Now, we've talked about domestic violence cases before, and I firmly believe this is one of those cases, regardless of how she died, okay? It's one of those cautionary tales. It doesn't have to get so bad that you didn't get a chance to find someone else that would value you like you deserve. And remember, I'm talking to you, if this applies to you, you don't have to wait to be hit. Abuse is not just physical. The controlling, isolating behaviors, those are all red flags. If they're not letting you speak to your parents or your friends, the verbal abuse, all of those things are abuse, and you can leave at any of those things.
For sure.
If you feel that that applies to you, if you're in the U.S., you can contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline. You can call 1-800-799-SAFE, 1-800-799-7233, or you can text START, START, to 88788, and I'll link that in the show notes. If you click that link, you can also chat live with someone, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And there is a warning when you go on their website. It says that abusers will sometimes monitor what you look at. Maybe go to your local library.
Oh, right.
Go to your local library, borrow someone's phone, do it from their phone if you feel like you're being monitored. And there are multiple countries that have their own hotlines, and we'd be here all day if I named them all. But if you reach out to the U.S. one, I'm sure they'll be able to
point
you in your direction. Or you can Google.
Wow.
Michelle.
That's a good reminder for all of those numbers, because we have listed them before. And it's, I think it's very important to keep reminding. But yeah, rest in peace, Michelle. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that happened to you.
You want to know what I think?
Yeah.
Here's what I think. This is just my opinion. We're all friends here, right? We can just share our thoughts.
Please do.
I think he pushed her over the balcony, and she was like, oh, down below. And he was like, well, crap. So he locked up the apartment, went downstairs, and hit her head against the concrete.
Why?
The left side.
Why would he lock the apartment up?
Why? Why would he do that either way? If he was concerned about her or whatever.
Or just trying to hurry and get down there and finish her off.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
I think she did fall from that balcony. It definitely looks like somebody went over the side, and I'll post the photos, but you can see where the top had been like scraped off. And that could have happened at any time. No doubt about that. But one thing that they mentioned in the crime scene confidential episode is that she didn't have any of that debris or that material on her clothing or anything like that. But you have to remember, she was moved multiple times. She was transported in the
ambulance.
Yeah. They cut her clothes off when she got to the hospital. You know, to say there was no material on her pants or shirt or whatever.
There's too many factors.
There are too many factors to say that that would have still been present. So anyway.
I don't like it.
The whole thing is just really, really sad.
Yeah.
It's just really sad. So that's what I got for you.
Well, thank you, Candace. That was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah. Let's do it again. Rest in peace, Michelle. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider leaving us a positive review and rating. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to our show.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or send case suggestions to cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.